talk about being in the spotlight. My name is Nicolette. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Zoom. If there's anybody there, I don't even know, but I'm just taking a moment. It never gets easier. I always get nervous. So my name is Nicolette. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is September 15, 2006. Not a date that I chose. I would say I was struck sober. I had a profound experience on that day that I really still can't really put into words. I was born and raised in Serbia. I would say it's an alcoholic country. You're not to be trusted if you're not drinking. I was warned about alcoholism at a young age. My father was an alcoholic. He's passed away from this illness. So was my grandma and other members of the family. I didn't really understand alcoholism, but I saw the destruction it created in the family, and I was actually, my mom and my dad married and divorced twice. My sister was from the first marriage, I was from the second, so, you know, no human power, my human power did not relieve my father's alcoholism. He didn't get him sober. He did try to get sober, and he was dry for about 2 years, and then on vacation in Greece, he saw a bottle and picked it up and never put it down again. And, you know, one thing that really brings up a lot of gratitude for me is that there was no AA in Serbia when my dad was getting sober. So he had no place to go to. No one he can relate to, no one he can identify with, no one that can point him the way or give him another way or tell him that perhaps there is another way to get sober and stay sober. So I feel incredibly lucky. I would say I was suffering from untreated alcoholism at a young age. My very first memory was coming into the house and watching my parents fight and watching my mom throw my dad out of the house and watching the bottles fly out of the house. And that was the very first conscious memory I had, the very first. Up until that moment, I had no thought. And the moment I had thoughts, problems started, you know. Because really, we're addicted to thinking. I'm addicted to thinking. And I think I know better. And I live in the stories in the mind. And I live in the virtual reality of my mind. And I was so hooked on like the neck up. Right? I was so disconnected from the neck down. You know, I was always scheming and planning the next move and, you know, what's around the corner, because I really didn't feel safe and I didn't really feel wholesome and I didn't really feel comfortable in my own skin. And life was not safe. From that very first memory, there was a conclusion somewhere that life was not safe and people can be trusted, you know, and that I'm not in control, so to speak, and that I need to be in control. And did I really think like that at 5 years old, at my first memory? Not necessarily. But through the work that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we start to, like, you know, go a little bit deeper and reflect a little bit more and sit with ourselves, like more gets revealed. A lot more gets revealed, like where am I stuck and where am I blind and where am I not looking and where am I avoiding and stuff like that. When I was 14, I came to New York City, and I was homeless within 2 weeks. It was December of 93. I was 14 years old with my mom and my sister, and what was going to be a two-week vacation ended up being, you know, pursuing the American dream as an immigrant and trying to make it. And there were like 2 years of really like struggling and hustling and living in abandoned buildings and, you know, being hungry and working four jobs and cleaning homes and cleaning hair salons at night and, you know, giving out flyers on the street. And I think that that had pluses, but that also kind of cemented, you know, the discord that I felt internally, like my internal emotional climate, right? I registered somewhere along the line. Not only was I tense, right? Not only was I like, life was tough, like, and I didn't feel like I had any reprieve, and I didn't feel safe in life, and life was scary, and I needed to show up, and I needed to pretend, but also I registered that I had to achieve, and that if I gained stuff, and I gained recognition, and I gained diplomas, and I gained achievements, and I got money, and you thought that I was doing really good, that that means I had arrived. And I relate to that in Bill's story when he talks about I had arrived, right? And, but on another note, on a deeper way, what that was also my philosophy in life was starting to be that I can rely on my mind to solve anything. Because I did succeed. At 16, I graduated high school, top of my class. I got accepted into a ton of universities. I put myself through college. I was making almost six figures at 19. I mean, I was living in an abandoned building at 15, and I was making six figures at 19. Talk about I had arrived, you know. And what happened at 16, I was living alone in New York City and supporting myself. So, you know, I got my hands on a bottle of gin because I was working in a restaurant. And, you know, I look back and I'm like, I brought the gin home where I drank it alone from the bottle. Like, off the bat, my drinking was, like, not normal. And, you know, like, it was love at first gulp. What did that do? I don't know what that did, but there was a conscious decision, I want to do that again. And I had a lot of fun. I had a blast in my late teens and early 20s with booze. I was loaded with money. I was successful. I was getting praised. I felt like I was achieving. What did alcohol do for me? It just kind of empowered me. Right? Deep down inside on my own, I know I'm powerless. I don't want to feel powerless. If I don't have power, that means I'm not in control. That means I don't have a choice. That means the life is not safe. I feel unsteady. I feel disconnected. So as I rely on my mind, I need to control. So alcohol gave me that power. It empowered me to meet life. It empowered me to... It created a drive to succeed and to achieve. And kind of like, I love when Bill talks about like the boomerang, it came back and cut me into pieces. Like, for a while, it looked like I was in control. It looked like I got this. I know how to live life and I know how to show up for life. But, you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, you don't drink like a lady. You know, you don't drink like a lady. And, you know, I didn't understand how much trouble I was in. I had no idea how much trouble I was in. You know, like, and I would give it reasons and stories. I deserve it, and I've earned it, and I had a tough week, and, oh, well, what's the big deal? I'm young, and it's New York, and everybody else. So, you know, tomorrow I'll do it differently. Or I really should, you know, lay off tequila, or lay off the scotch, or lay off the whiskey, or whatever. I liked hard liquor. And I took a wine course where I got drunk. To me, that was funny. It was funny that I was the only one who couldn't get up at the end of the wine course where you're supposed to spit it out, but I would always drink it. I didn't understand why I was always thirsty. I didn't understand why I never had a happy hour. I didn't understand how many times I went to a bar after work to hang out with my bartender friend and just take the edge off. Just take the edge off for an hour and then go home to shower, to prepare for the next day, to pay the bills, to open the mail, to do these basic things, and I would be closing the bar. Over and over and over again. I didn't understand the alcoholic craving or the phenomenon of craving that happens physically in the body. It took me a long time to understand that I was powerless over alcohol once I picked up. That once I picked up a drink, all bets were off, and I don't know what kind of ride or a roller coaster ride most of the time towards the end of my drinking it would take me for. Right? And so that's one thing, but that I'm powerless over alcoholism or alcohol mentally, that's really the kicker for me. That's really the kicker because there were moments, there were periods of, do you call them sobriety? Dry briarity, which lasted for a few days. I don't even know what to call, you know, the dry spell of, you know, going away on vacation or with family or to an event or being distracted by a new relationship or someone I'm trying to impress or something that I'm trying to achieve, you know, career-wise or something like that. And the mind would always bring me back to the drink. It would always tell me a story. Even though I tried not to drink for just a little bit or like do like an alcohol diet, so to speak, because I saw that it was starting to impact my life. At some point in my mid-20s, it got really ugly. it just got ugly. Like, it got so ugly that I couldn't, like, pretend it wasn't ugly. You know, I just couldn't pretend it wasn't ugly. There's a lot of stories, and I don't know that they are so important, because I think the emotional memory of drinking, and for us to alcoholics to reflect on the emotional memory of drinking, I think that's more important, you know, no matter how much the mind will throw some story around it and excuse it and justify it and all of that. Like I see now looking back that I was telling myself that I was in control. And that it was too much to not admit powerlessness. In Bill's story, he talks about 6 beers and gin would be needed for him to eat breakfast. And the very next sentence in his story says, nevertheless, I still thought I could control it. Something like that, right? That's literally alcoholism. That the alcoholic mind, that's how it takes. It constantly puts me back in this loop where it does not want me to see how I relate to life and what role I play. It doesn't, right? And this whole time, you know, resentments are stewing because there's fear about, like, meeting life on life's terms, that I really don't know how to live and I don't know how to connect and I don't know how to be a true friend and I don't know how to date and be a girlfriend and stand true to my word and how to be a daughter and a sister and life becomes like a game and it becomes like a chess piece and I have to constantly think about what's the next move and what's your next move because I need to come out on top because somehow I feel like a failure. Any alcoholic knows what I'm talking about. It's so much more than drinking. We can all talk about, man, when I start drinking, I can't stop. I get it. But like, on some deeper level, like, why am I pissing my pants on the floor every night alone? It's odd. I mean, it doesn't even look happy or healthy, right? Because booze is doing something for me. It's doing something for me. It's allowing me to breathe. It's doing something for me that I can't seem to get. I can't seem to have or get when I'm not drunk or when I don't have that. I just don't have, and you know, so at some point, you know, liquor becomes a necessity, it says in the big book, and I can relate to that. You know, I never thought that I'd be a daily drinker. I didn't think I was going to have public seizures at 26 years old. I didn't think that I was going to get a warning letter from my job that because I was sending messengers out to get me booze, and I was hiding, you know, whiskey in my Snapple bottle, and I was, unattractive to friends because I was unavailable, because I wasn't present, because I was bringing nothing to the table. I was so wrapped up in how much life has wronged me. I couldn't see any role that I played. That's the game of alcoholism. It always constantly looks out. It's your fault. There's someone else to blame. It's what has happened to me. You know, there's no other way. It's incredibly self-destructive, right? And yet, somewhere deep down inside, you know, we all just, I mean, I do. I just want to be real. I want to connect. I want to feel safe. I don't think it's possible or available. And, I went to therapy and, you know, lied to him and tried to convince him that I'm not an alcoholic while drinking in his bathroom and, so 27 years old. I lost everything. I'm at a place in my life where I can't even walk out of my apartment in New York City to go downstairs to check the mailbox. I'm riddled by fear. I can't even get drunk enough. I need to pass out when I drink. I'm in that place of like, you can't like even, like the booze is not working anymore. And it's getting ugly. I look bad. I smell bad. I'm alone. I'm alone, but I'm also experiencing that loneliness that only an alcoholic understands that happens at some point on the journey of alcoholism, right? And I'm so wrapped up in the virtual reality of my mind. It's all in the head. It's nothing is questioned. Nothing in my mind is questioned. Nothing that my mind says is questioned by me. I didn't know you can question anything. I didn't know you can question. Is it true? Really? Always? Never? Did your father abandon you? Oh, no. Your parents got divorced. But, you know, abandoning me is more dramatic. And, you know, it works a little bit more to make me feel like a victim or to make me feel like a martyr, depending on who I'm standing in front of, so I can continue to drink and do whatever I want and not stand on my own 2 feet and not take ownership for my life and how I feel. And this is what I do. I'm the greatest liar. We are so good at deceiving ourselves. We're so good at deceiving ourselves. And so, September 15, 2006, I'm getting evicted from my apartment because I'm no longer paying the bill. I have been unemployed at that point for about 9 months. I am been embarrassed and ashamed. I've already had some medical conditions that related to alcoholism. I'm malnourished. I'm gray. My liver's failing. I'm having seizures. I'm dehydrated. My apartment is a mess. I have cut off all ties with my family. I don't want to talk to anybody because I'm unapproachable, because anybody that tries to come to me to put a mirror in front of my face, it's too painful. It's just too painful. And I don't see a way out. And so on September 15, 2006, after attending an AA meeting, in those last couple of months, I tried to go to a meeting. All the broken promises of, you know, at that point, I was trying not to drink for one day. We don't need to talk a lot about our drinking stories on step one. As far as I'm concerned, if you drank when you didn't want to drink, what's more powerless than that? What's more powerless than drinking when you don't want to drink? You don't want to do it. You know you shouldn't do it. You know you're going to lose a lot if you do it. You don't really even have the money for it. You're in a lot of debt. I was in so much debt. I was scrambling to pretend that I have this under control. You know, just clean it up, you know, fix it. You know, get them off your back. Pretend like you got this. There was none of that at the end. And September 5th, so I went to an AA meeting. Oh, by the way, I graduated college with a philosophy degree, and my thesis was proof that there's no God. So that's funny, because it's the most important relationship in my life today, and it has been for the last 16 years of my sobriety. And so my God's super funny, and needed to be, you know, life, you know, alcoholism is my spiritual path. It's the spiritual path. Like, nothing else was going to bring me to my knees. I was so full of myself. You know, I know, you know, I got this. I'll figure it out. I'll survive it. I've been through worse. I came out on top. And not with alcoholism. And that's another thing about step one. Like, I often wondered, I remember in early career, why does step one need to be perfect? And you don't do step one when you come into AA. I did my step one for, like, when I got sober at 27. And I started at 16. I didn't really start maybe alcoholically at 16. I wouldn't say it was like dirty and ugly like it was at, you know, 23, 4, 5, 6, you know. But that was my step one. My drinking was my step one for me. That was the experience of being powerless. And the unmanageability, that's external, but also internal. When I stop drinking and I don't have that solution, and I don't have any other solution to replace it with. But what I was going to say is, why is it that that's the only step you need to do perfectly? Because I need to know what the problem is in order to pursue the solution. If I don't know what the problem is, why would I take the steps? Why would I do radical things like give them back money they don't even know I owe them? They don't even know I took the money. Why would I amend that? Look at myself, write inventory, confessional element of a fix, get vulnerable with somebody. I remember going to an AA meeting in New York. I was drunk. I sat in the back. They mentioned God. There was a break. I ran away. So that was the first experience, but I registered two things. How the hell is sitting here in this meeting going to get me sober? which I saw the value of that much later in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was some truth to that. And just sitting in a meeting does not get me sober. There was so much more that came with the package that I didn't understand, right? But there was also a safe energy and an acceptance that I sat there smelling like booze. And I was a total stranger, and I didn't feel judged, and nobody asked me to leave, and nobody threw me out. There was an impression that was left on me. A seed was planted, even though I wasn't ready to take it fully. The second AA meeting I went to, I was in the back of this dark room in New York City. I was hungover this time, thinking about drinking, because when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And he was this biker dude, like he was intimidating looking, he was like a biker, he was like tough, he was like a midnight meeting, and he was so vulnerable. I was like, why the hell would you say that to them? I was like, who gets this honest, like who talks like this? And he kept saying, it's in the book, and he kept like pounding his fist, in the book, and I'm like, what? Book is he talking about? You know, I didn't say that to anybody because I was too scared to talk to anybody and I was totally unapproachable. But I said to myself, maybe I should get that book in Barnes & Noble. Check it out. What is that book saying? You know? So that's like a little funny story of mine. I'm glad somebody laughed. Okay. So September 15, 2006 was just another day of me trying to convince myself that I'm in control and I can manage my drinking and my thinking and my life and that I'll figure out a way to get out of this and tomorrow I'll figure out a way and there's a reason why I'm doing it and life sucks and I'm depressed and I'm sad and I'm lonely and I'm lost. I'm so much more than that. I'm like lost. I'm confused. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. And I need a drink. So I scrounged up like 99 pennies and I bought a Colt at the bodega and I saw the bodega guy look at me like I was a bum. And they were always the bums. I always looked at them as the bums. But this time I saw his look and I looked like a bum. I smelled like a bum. I was at the end of my life basically. I bought the 99-cent Colt. I finished that. And then I remembered from the corner of my eye I saw in my neighbor's freezer a bottle. And I, you know, I said, yeah, can you, give me, he gave me a drink, not enough. And I remember sitting on the floor of my apartment. It was, my life was messy on the outside, but it was complete hell on the inside, right? And I just couldn't get drunk enough anymore. And the consequences, the reality of the consequences of alcoholism and the pain of alcoholism was so in my face, I couldn't avoid it anymore. Excuse it, explain it away. Like anything that stood in the way of me not seeing the truth was taken away. The people in my life, the lovers, the friends, the family, the money, the job, the reputation, the success, the looks, the financial stability, the apartment, everything was taken away for me to just see a simple truth. And there was this moment that my final solution to my alcoholism was to end my life. And I meant it. And now I look back at that moment and I go, that is the best my mind can do. That's the best. That is the best I can do. That's the best solution I can come up with to end my life. No wonder that alcoholics have the highest rate of suicide. The best I can do is end this misery, this depression, this loneliness, this disconnection, this spiritual malady, this internal, like emotional climate and this kind of temperature that I'm living by. It's just not sustainable anymore. I'm like literally dying. That the only solution to that kind of painful death is to actually end my life. And yet something in me wanted to live also. And there was a prayer. I didn't know that was the prayer. It was the most honest prayer I have ever said in my life, and it wasn't to God. It was a prayer of, I just can't do this anymore. I can't stop drinking, period. I can't stop drinking, period, was the conclusion of step one. And Bill talks about it in his story when he talks about no words can tell. It's not intellectual. That's why words can't tell it. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Right? Quicksand stretched all around me. Quicksand, the more you try to get out of quicksand, the more you go into the quicksand, right? The more I'm efforting to control and manage my drinking, the more I'm drowning. That was exactly the metaphor for what I was trying to do. And I didn't know that the solution to my alcoholism had to come from some other place than my mind, and that I couldn't rely on my mind. And it's kind of like the experience that Bill has in his story. And we don't relate to Bill. We relate to how he drinks and thinks. That's what we relate to, which is why it's so classic and timeless. And we lost our members. How am I doing?
Doing great.
Okay, great. Okay. Whew. So then time stopped. It just, time stopped. And 16 years, I'm honoring that second. 16 years, I've been sober. It always stopped. Like, what happened? I don't know. It was profound. It was sudden. It's like I went from, I want to kill myself, my life is over, to I can't do this anymore, I can't stop drinking, I can't do this, to manipulated pause and an intuitive thought that came from some other place than my mind to ask for help. And I banged on that neighbor's door and I begged him for a quarter, because that's what you needed to make a paid phone call from a payphone on a New York City corner. And I called my sister until she hung up, because I didn't want to lose that corner, that quarter, on that corner, quarter corner. And I already knew that everything I did from that moment, my life depended on it. I look back, and in that split second was the experience of steps 1, 2, and 3. I had no idea. I gave my life over to the unknown. I stepped into the unknown. I didn't trust my mind anymore. I wanted to do whatever to save my life. It didn't matter where I went. It didn't matter when she picked me up, how long I was going to be somewhere. It didn't, nothing mattered. Nothing mattered. And a true experience, you know, we call it a moment of like clarity, or we call it grace, an undeserved gift. I didn't do anything to get this gift. There's no magic formula for the gift, right? I was exhausted. All of my ways got exhausted. All of my ways got exhausted. And I call it fierce grace because, you know, a ton of consequences were in place and a ton of pain was in place for me to see a simple truth that I can't stop drinking. Period. Not that I can do anything about it tomorrow, or there's someone to blame, or there's something to do. There's just like, oh, I can't stop. I haven't been able to stop for a long time, but like, I saw that. And the mental obsession was removed. I'm a girl that could not put the bottle down. Not a glass, a bottle down. Daily. Daily. And I was, you know, my sister picked me up and she says, I said, on that payphone, when she finally picked up the phone, she said, I said, just please help me. I can't do this anymore. Like, I gave my life over to her first. I gave my life over to something else, something other than me. I no longer trusted me. I no longer managed my life. I no longer directed. I was no longer the director. All of this is talked about in the big book, in first and second and third step. I didn't have to have a spiritual or a religious base to have this recognition that I can't rely on my mind, that there is another way, that I need help, that I don't know. Highest spiritual concept, I don't know. If I don't know, that doesn't mean that there isn't a knowing. And so I go into treatment in Pennsylvania. And I remember coming in there and they're like, and I walked out of that New York City apartment with nothing. Never looking back. My stuff, my memories, my achievements, pictures, art, things. Nothing. I walked out, the clothes on me, all mismatched, just like that, and walked into, got into a treatment center in Pennsylvania, and she asked me, why are you here? And I said, I don't want to die. And they handed me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she told me to read first 164 pages, and then they plopped me into detox, where I couldn't sleep the first night anyway. I was buzzing with fear and nervous energy and confusion and safety. It was so weird. Like, I felt safe, but I felt like a baby learning how to walk. Everything was new. You know, there was a great amount of vulnerability in that. Very powerful. I thought I needed to be tough and cool and prove myself to the world. Be vulnerable. That's courageous. That vulnerability comes from some, like, deeper level of truth. When that's present, everybody moves around you differently, too. It's like universe just supports and gives. It's like just magical. And I heard 64 pages, so I stopped on page 64 thinking the mind took over, like there's something magical here. Why did she have me stop in the middle of a whatever. I didn't even understand what I was reading. It was all Japanese to me. I could only relate to Bill's drinking a little bit, but like rocketing into the fourth dimension of existence and like, what are you talking about? Like, nobody talks like this. Nobody, not in my world. I don't talk like this. I don't know what you mean when you say spiritual malady. I don't know what you mean when you say unmanageable. I don't know what that means, powerless. I don't understand. But it's so funny, the message gets transmitted a lot of times, not intellectually. Transformation can happen on a deeper level, right? We can walk into a room in Alcoholics Anonymous, we can go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we can hear a speaker, you can't remember one thing that speaker said, but you leave and your heart's open. You got touched. Something got registered. Weeks down the line, days down the line, it just comes out of nowhere. You're like, where'd that come from? Well, how come I just said that? You don't even know where it came from. Or sometimes we sit at a meeting and we hear a message of recovery and they see things we have never said before, never read before, and we know that they're true. They touch us because the truth in us recognizes that truth in the message. Something gets recognized from some depth. I didn't know that I didn't know myself. I didn't know that I didn't know how to be my own best friend. I didn't know that I was driven by fears and conditioning and things I never questioned and ideas and judgments about life. I didn't know that anger was eating me up. My frustrations, my resentments, my discontent with life, my ideas about what should have been different and how you should have been different and how that shouldn't have happened. I was arguing with life all the time. I was constantly arguing with reality. You argue with reality, you argue with God. That's playing God. When I'm in constant conflict with what's here in front of me. I can talk all I want that I shouldn't be at this meeting speaking right now, but I'm here at this meeting, so feet first. My feet are here. Where's my feet? What is happening in this moment is the only thing that's happening, and it's meant to be happening. And how can I yield to that more? What would happen if I surrendered more deeply? What would happen if I trusted that? The most difficult things that happened in my life ended up giving me the greatest gifts in my life. Who's to say that sometimes I'm not in the middle of a difficult experience that's going to bear fruit later, that's going to be necessary, or a stepping stone, or an opportunity of some kind, right? And I stayed in this treatment, and I didn't want to leave, and because I didn't want to leave, they felt that I was ready to leave. So I put myself in a halfway house. I was like, I'm not going to New York. I'm going to drink. I don't have the mental obsession anymore, and I know I'm going to drink. That's a step one experience. When you know you're going to drink, why do I know I'm going to drink? Because I always drink. That's what I do. I drink no matter what. That's my experience. I was so afraid. I have tremendous respect for alcoholism. That's another thing. We need to see its power over us. We need to give it like a little respect. I've met my match. Alcohol was my master. I have been defeated. These are serious words. What's your experience with these words? How do you move when you feel that? It's not a weakness or a failure. It's the truth. It's the necessary stepping stone to the next experience. That's true. That's being real. That's being honest. And so I put myself in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania got me sober.
Hey, yeah.
All right, so that's my Don drives me 90 minutes here. Thank you, Don. And I went to a halfway house for women, and I read every piece of AA literature. I didn't understand it. I sat in meetings. I listened. I didn't understand you. I was just, I think, sponging at that time and just being there. I was just being, and maybe buying time. I asked a couple of women to sponsor me. They said no, which I'm grateful for, and I'll tell you why. It was time for me to leave this place. I had 4 months sober. I've been locked down for 120 days at this point, being told when to pee, eat, smoke, and what chore to do, if you know what I mean, right? Which I had no issues with because I felt safe from alcohol. And I chose a sober house in New Jersey that's close to New York, but not in New York, to start building my life. And I end up in the sober house on January 13, 2007. And I'm still there. It's a crazy story. I'm not still there as a resident, if you know what I mean, because that would be kind of weird. But I came there and I met my sponsor the next day. She was doing a meditation, 11-step big book thing meeting at the sober house. And we met, and she told me the truth about how much trouble I was in and what I suffered from. She qualified me immediately, and she said, my job is to get you independent of me and get you dependent on God or life or universe or higher power, whatever you want to call it, right? And I want to tell you the truth about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to take you through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous so you can have an experience with these steps. And the only reason I'm doing this is so that you can help others. Give this away. And sure, you know, we all been like, yeah, sure, okay. Meanwhile, I don't think I have anything to give away. That's kind of like all the way down the line and like whatever, you know. And I had this most incredible experience with what sponsorship means. And how we hold each other, right? And I'm, you know, and you guys helped me up. With or without a sponsor, sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you were sober, and I didn't necessarily want, which some of you had, and some of you were weird, and some of you were really weird, and, you know, but some of you were happy. Not just happy. Forget happy. You had freedom in your eyes. You were holding confidence and humility at the same time, which I didn't think was possible. I didn't think you could be confident and free and humble in the same way, in the same moment. This was stuff that I found attractive, and I think this is what they mean by attraction rather than promotion. We get to be the example. She was an example of the big book, how she lived, how she be. Her being was attractive to me. So I trusted her. I trusted what she said, even though it was radical and even though I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why she wanted me to sit silently for 2 minutes a day. But when I tried to cheat after 30 seconds because it was so uncomfortable to sit in my own skin, I understood that these were all exercises and ways for me to get closer to myself and to see that what I'm up against and to get curious. And to get grounded and to get present and to start, you know, chiseling away at the stories I built around my life and the past that were keeping me shackled to like anger and resentment. And so everything was up for a review. I was willing to step into the unknown. When I had doubt, I remember calling her on a payphone from a sober house, and I called her up and I said, I have doubt. You know, there's a God in my life that knows me, that's going to be personal to me in my life. And she said, doubt, doubt. And I was like, blown away. I was like, okay. And it was just like steps like that, leaning on her experience, being curious about AA, going to every big book study, every step workshop, you know, hearing tons of speakers and CDs and stories and listening about history of AA, because then the big book became more real to me when I knew some of the names and the dates in the big book, you know, that these were like real examples of real people that they're using, you know, and stuff like that. When I practice prayer, like she told me, when I started with the third step prayer on a daily basis, and it wasn't personal to me, so I wrote my own, which was like one line. And, you know, it wasn't about, was there a God listening? The act of prayer was softening me. The act of prayer was inviting humility into my life. The act of prayer was saying, I'm not alone and I don't have to do this alone. Even if it was a reprieve that was only for a few seconds, that then the mind swooped in and doubted it. No one heard that. What's the God? You don't believe in God. What do you mean by God? Blah, 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 blah. The act itself, the humility behind willing to take suggestions that I didn't understand, made me feel more part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It at least made me feel like I was willing to follow these directions as outlined in the book to see if I can have the experience you had, which I doubted that I could have, or I doubted that I could have personal to me. And yet I have this fifth step of the experience, which I'm petrified of, and I wrote this inventory to the best of my ability, and I prayed every time I wrote, and she gave me a short amount of time to complete it so that my mind doesn't take me for a spin and to be real, and I write these resentments, and I write these fears and sex and harms to the best of my ability in this relationship ideal in my little sober house room on my own, you know, trying to do it for half an hour a day and noticing that every time I'm supposed to write, I want to do everybody's chore. And I want to nap. I never nap. I don't nap. I'm not a napper. I don't nap. I napped in the sober house. I watched Law and Order, like episode after episode after episode. I'm like, I don't watch Law and Order. I noticed, the exercise was notice that something wants to not have you dive into the truth and prevent you from sitting with yourself. Notice how uncomfortable it can be to sit with yourself. How can I walk through life when I can't even be with my own self? Right? And then the fifth step was like, I just, you know, just the whole experience of the fifth step, like, I remember walking out of the fifth step. Nothing's changed in my life, but everything changed. Nothing's changed. My dad was the same, my mom was the same, my sister was the same, that guy was the same, that ex-guy was the same, that ex-ex-guy was the same, that professor was the same, that neighbor, that boss was the same. All of that stuff was the same, but I was different. Something in me shifted, and I realized in the experience of this fifth step how much trouble I really was in with alcoholism. I saw that this is so much more than drinking. Drinking was a solution to how I relate to life and how I view life, which is a failed system. I'm operating on a failed system. It doesn't work. Do whatever you want, I say to people. But does it work? How are you? Do you feel happy, joyous, and free? You're right? I don't care. It's your life. You live it. I'm not going to live your life for you. I tell my sponsees, I tell residents at the sober house, it's your life. Have your own experience. Have your journey. How's it working? Did the tree bear the fruit or no? Are the roots planted firmly in truth? In truth. We can debate about God and step work all we want, but how you doing? What's your life looking like? How you showing up? Do you wake up with the shoes about to drop feeling? Life is not safe. No one can be trusted. Life sucks. Is this it? You know? Is that maybe a indication that something's missing or something's lacking? Maybe I can come a little closer. Maybe I can surrender a little deeper. Right? 6 and 7 showed me how powerless I was over my own character defects. I can wish them away all I want. I can know better. I can intellectualize them. I can tell myself a million times I'm going to get up at 4 in the morning and go to the damn gym. I don't get up at 4 in the morning and go to the gym. I don't. I know it's good for me. I know I should do it. It would be nice. Why don't you should do a few yoga poses? You're 43 years old, Nicolette. I don't. I still smoke. I'm not done. I haven't reached the step one with my smoking. I'm 16 years sober. It's like, I know it's not good. I'm just not there yet. I'm in the midst of it. I'm in the middle of the experience. It's not painful yet enough. I'm still in a relationship with it. I'm in a relationship with some of these things. I think they work for me. They do something for me. 6 and 7 is lifelong. It's lifelong. You know, 8 was just a list of everything and everyone I saw in 4 and whatever more God revealed. But the experience of making all the amends, and I didn't make all the amends. And it took me 3 years to make all the amends. And some of them were financial amends. And some of them I was scared to make. And some of them I didn't know how to reach. I was just saying on the right here, one of the amends I made, I didn't even think it worked. I didn't feel that satisfaction. Like I got validated, praised, like, you know. As a matter of fact, I felt looked down on. Like, oh, you're in a sober house in Dover. Like, oh, okay. You work in a sober house? I used to run a multi-million-dollar company. And I was living in an office in a sober house. You know what I mean? I had very little. I had to build all over again in my late 20s and early 30s. And, you know, this guy knew me. He knew my successes and achievements. And I felt looked up. But 6 months later, he gets diagnosed with a rare illness. And he's incredibly wealthy, and he's like surrounded by the best doctors at the Mayo Clinic, and he's paralyzed from the neck down with this rare illness. And he had no one to call to tell them that he was grateful for sunrise that day. He thought of me. I made amends to a friend of mine that I used to drink with when I came around after disappearing from my old life, my drinking life. I came around with this amends. He was so stunned by the transformation he saw and so moved that he left the meeting and walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and got sober. And he's been sober for 13 years. And you know, like the mind wants to take credit for that. Yeah, my amends, right? Yeah, my. Yeah, the key word is my. But I'm just like, every time he texts me on his sober anniversary, and shares the impact of that, like an example of the big book or someone living the big book or someone taking a step into the unknown with no pride or whatever, you know, and owning, taking ownership, allowing some healing, listening, being present. You know, I'm like, oh my God, I'm like a part of this like mysterious way that God shows up and connects us all. Because no awakening is real unless you think of others. You cannot have a spiritual awakening and not think of others. Do I want to think about you? I don't want to think about you. Do I want to do service? Do I want to ask Dawn to drive me 90 days to a speaking commitment in Quakertown on a Monday night? No, part of me doesn't. No, there's nothing in it for me, the mind, the ego. But, you know, the book talks about, and on every coin says, to thine own self be true. Which self? Because it says, self manifested in various ways is what defeated us. Which is the self and which is us? Is there something deeper? Is this why the book on page 55 talks about it is deep down within us? Each of us, deep down within us, within each man, woman, and child, is the fundamental idea of God. It's obscured by calamity, worship, pride, ego, mental stories, and all of that, right? But it's there. How do I connect to that place that knows better? How do I connect to that place that when you're hurting, I'm hurting too? And it's not of the mind. This is why the St. Francis prayer, step 11, does not make sense to the mind. This is why the mind can't sit still. And there's been many experiences with steps 10 and 11, mostly like being a witness and being in reflection and questioning and being and just because, you know, and like not like what I want, but what's wanted. Not what I need, but what's needed. You know, can I see through the eyes of God today? What would love say to this? Why am I disturbed again? I know better. I get disturbed. I get angry. I get resentful. I get short. I get cranky. All of it. I have spot check inventory. I was so mad before a meeting on Wednesday. I went to a meeting on Wednesday. In the meeting, I did spot check inventory. I walked out of that meeting teary-eyed and humbled, taking my own inventory. My whole world shifted in 1 hour. 1 hour. We're so lucky. We hit the jackpot. We hit the jackpot with AA and 12 steps. I mean, like, if you don't believe me, just Dalai Lama says it. He says it's like the greatest thing that happened to humanity in the 21st century. I think the guy knows a thing or two. I mean, he's pretty enlightened. Like, there is, it's very juicy what we have here. And we, and you know, it'll meet me wherever I'm at. He'll meet me and I can take it as deep as I want to go because I will always come back to that step one and have an opportunity to have deeper surrenders. And to wrap this up, step 12 is like the greatest cherry on the top. It's like the cake that I want and I can eat it too. Something like that is the idiom. I get both. I don't even know why Americans say that. I have the cake and eat it too. Yeah, of course I'm going to eat the cake that I have. But in the spirit of the American idiom, it's the whole shebang, right? It's the whole shebang because anything I didn't see, anything I didn't understand, anything that wasn't clear to me, I saw in the women that I took through the work. Every time I took them through the book, I went through the book. Every time I told them to do something, I was a hypocrite if I wasn't doing it. Every time I heard a fifth step, I heard things that moved me and reminded me and that hit me like a mirror looking back at me. You know what I mean? So that was an experience in itself, which this is why I say no spiritual awakening is complete without thinking of others or wanting to naturally share it or ease some suffering or make use of this experience that I've had, because then this experience that I've had and all the hurt that my alcoholism created is really not useful or worthy. Unless it can be used for me to relate to someone, identify with someone. The greatest thing, the greatest compliment I get today is, you drank? Because I'm like a nerd now. You know, this is like bedtime. You know, being in Quakertown. You know what I mean? Like, people have no idea. Do you know what I mean? That's talk about being reborn. That we have been given an opportunity to be reborn, to relate to life in a completely different way. I get afraid, but I get excited. I'm afraid of public speaking, but I trust enough to show up. Like I know not to trust me. I know that much. And it's there. I'm sweating. I'm like, you know, trying to convince everybody else that knows me for years that I'm nervous. And they're like, Nick, stop. Just shut up. But, you know, it's still there. There's still some wounds and insecurities and doubts and, like, character defects that show up and ways that I'm wired and, like, stuff like that. And there's just more for me to mine. You know, this gold mine that keeps giving. It just really keeps giving. And I gotta say that the most radical thing I've done in AA is sit in silence, which I feel is the highest form of prayer. We say that the greatest prayer in the big book is, your will not mine be done. Your will not mine be done. And there's absolutely no greater surrender than complete silence. I don't even have to say it. To sit with my own self. The greatest, most courageous thing I've seen. And if you want to know how crazy your mind is, sit. Sit. You'll be like thinking about breakfast. You'll have a song you don't even like stuck in your head on repeat. You'll be wondering about that noise next to you, right? And it is the most challenging thing I've ever done, and the one that really showed me that I'm, you know, powerless over alcohol is a great metaphor for what's really going on. I have no control. I have no control. That's the name of the whole game. The whole game is like, I don't have power. And yet, when I'm tapped, when I'm aligned with reality, when I'm aligned with reality, and when I'm in the present moment, everything I need is given to me and revealed to me. And I'm directed, and I can't really claim it. That's pretty cool. So thanks for having me. I think I took it to 9. All right, I did it.